Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
It's spinning! It's spinning! Jonathan Sexton has made it!
Do you feel moderately happy?
No, I feel like I've been kissing my sister, I suppose.
In the pocket for his drop goal attempt. Here he goes, O'Gara. He's done it! That surely is the grand slam.
We target players all the time. That's part of rugby, isn't it? Let me know.
Sexton! Wonderful pass and Stockdale finishes.
There'll be more than grenades. There'll be full tanks and full shells landing on the Aviva.
Grand Slam winners on St. Patrick's Day at Twickenham.
Well then, we're going to review round four of the Six Nations and look ahead to the final weekend. A win for Ireland against France, very dominant, 26 points to 14, doesn't quite tell the full story of that dominance. England put a 43-point winning margin on Italy, 57 points to 14, and Wales' Grand Slam hopes very much intact, 18 points to 11. 13 wins in a row, they won at Murrayfield. Brian O'Driscoll here, hello.
Hey there.
Crisis over. We're back. you never felt there was a crisis, it's fair to say.
No, I didn't. I just knew you couldn't drop from that standard from November back, you know, 60% without bouncing back very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same players, it's the same patterns, it's the same policy, it's the same defensive coach. So it was just a little bit of a rut, and I think the stuffing completely got knocked out of us from the English performance, and it's taken a couple of games for it to bounce back. I suppose I did TV on yesterday afternoon as well, and having watched the game again today, I would be more confident with the performance than perhaps I was at the time. But I think I was just annoyed with France with how they started the game, and they sort of rubbed me up the wrong way. And that, you know, to allow Ireland into the game as seamlessly as they did within 3 minutes. Is exactly what France didn't need, and I think maybe I didn't see the upside of how good Ireland were taking them through phases, particularly for that first 40 minutes. You know, there was some really good passages of play, and they created a lot of opportunities and could have gotten another couple of scores for sure. But overall, you know, 26 points, two late scores will annoy them, but it's a pretty decent performance and sets next week up brilliantly.
When you talk about France rubbing you up the wrong way, you're talking about them almost leaving a quarter of the pitch empty, so that Larmour, even though maybe he hadn't intended to kick, had no choice but to kick.
He wasn't kicking. He wasn't. It's 30 seconds into the game. Ramos has kicked the ball down, you know, a decent ball because Sexton's had to go back for it, and he fumbles it going backwards, and he ships it across to Larmour. And you can see from the angle of run of what Larmour's doing is he's thinking counter-attack. I think it's his first port of call is to go to the run game because it's his best game because of the footwork. And we saw that littered throughout the game. He had some sparkling moments. But he didn't have any other opportunity other than to kick it. In fairness, the defensive line came up and pressed hard, but at the risk of leaving the whole backfield open. And there was a few people guilty. Obviously, Ramos was the one that kicked it, but he was part of the chase line. So immediately, you know, one of the halfbacks has to fill back into that backfield. One of the back three players, one of the two wingers, you know, particularly Huge on that left side, because as soon as the ball shifted from Sexton across to Larmour, he's got to start patrolling the midfield, knowing that Ramos is gone. Mm. Like, not paying any attention to that is unbelievable. And Pinot, in fairness to him, probably has to play high because the defensive, it looks as though it's going to be a counter-attack, so he's got to be up and you know, not offer them that corner. But Larmour then squares up. You know, he has to, because he's running across the pitch, and then he squares up to get the ball on a good line to be able to pump it into the corner. It's a brilliant kick, and Pinot has to nudge it out. And that ultimately is the platform that Ireland needed to get their first 7 points.
Not to spend 10 minutes dissecting this moment, but maybe it's emblematic
for
the wider
picture.
For
me, it's a big moment. Yeah. It is a big moment.
Huge kind of just hands in his pockets.
Pickamole's in that backfield waiting for the kick for kick tennis. So if Sexton launches it back to him, he's down there. And Huge's basically, they're within 10 yards of each other, knowing that, and Huge's seen Ramos kick it and getting into the chase line, so straight away he's got to fill the middle of the field. And it's actually Pickamoles is the one that runs across and helps with Pinot. Mm. If Pinot doesn't get back in time, Picamo is the one that maybe kicks in at the touch or makes the tackle on, is it Earls' wing? No, it's Stockdale's wing. And I'm aghast at,
really?
At how bad defensively that is. Like, we were in the studio and we were all shocked, right, within touching distance of the kickoff. It's just the lack of organisation or understanding of when one person is out of position, you've got to facilitate someone else going in.
Is it so bad? Would you expect a good AIL player?
Undoubtedly.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly.
Really?
How someone isn't thinking, well, there's our fullback kicking the ball and getting into the chase line. Who's going to fill his position?
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. If that happened at schools rugby, you'd be crying out. You'd be pulling your hair out.
Okay.
So I think they got me... off on a bad footing, and they offered very little. You know, defensively they were hard and physical. Mm. But in fairness to Ireland, no Six Nations side is going to lie down. And it's a big, tough French side. They don't have a huge amount more. It was more the team that played against England than the one that played against Scotland. But overall, pleased with how Ireland played, and I think they'll be happy with the confidence. You could see in a couple of the tries, the satisfaction, the reaction after the game. Anytime you beat France by 12 points, it's a good day at the office, and it should have been beating them by 26 points.
Absolutely. So Joe Schmidt said he'd never seen in his time as Ireland coach dominance like that for 40 minutes, just so sustained. The French spent 5 seconds in the Irish 22. I would say those first 5 seconds may have been it, really. Brunel, he didn't get the stats quite right. He said Ireland had 99% possession in that first half. We didn't have the ball. We didn't have the chance to do anything. They choked us. The stats were 89% territory, 77% possession. France made 125 tackles in the first half. That was as bad as the French clearly were. That was an extraordinary level of dominance sustained for 40 minutes.
Yeah, it was. They beat them up. And for that French pack, they would have seen what England did to Ireland, and they would have thought the way to beat Ireland is to out-muscle them, and it was quite the opposite. They got pushed around, they got beaten in collision, save for the odd Bastereau hit. Mm. Ireland were in massive control, and as I said, there was another couple of try-scoring opportunities that went a begging, be it through, if there could have been quicker hands from Larmour at one stage to Stockdale, who was... unmarked out on the wing, Gary Ringrose, that great catch, and then subsequent knock on going over the try line. So you felt as though Ireland were definitely worthy of their 19-point halftime lead, and probably should have had a bit more. So yeah, France had their opportunity. Like, it's not as though France were starved of possession with no errors from Ireland. Like, there were, I don't know, were there 5-6 knock ons? So they would have had at least 4 or 5 scrums. The same in lineouts. I'm not sure exactly of the stats, but somewhere close to launch from. Mm. Their ability to take Ireland through phases was not good in any shape or form. Did they get beyond 7-8 phases throughout the whole game? Mm. I'd question that. And then, credit to Ireland, I thought their line speed was much improved.
Yeah.
They weren't thinking about drifting off. They were hard off the line. They were in their faces. So I think it's a combination of the two from a French attacking perspective. It's a little bit blunt, but also good Irish defence.
Was that Irish line speed there last year and they got away from them a bit this year?
Yeah, I think... Yeah, there's a confidence thing as well. And when you're... when you're firing and when the confidence is high, you get excited in defence. You just wonder were they a bit tentative in defence as well? And as I said, their whole game was affected by how they were nullified in the English performance. Mm. So it did take two other 80-minute performances and a training session and maybe a bonding session up in Ulster that's gotten so much airtime.
Keane Healy came out during the week and said, "We're not in hell. We're actually okay."
Like, the players at no point felt the panic of the nation. They were reading, I'm sure they were reading the press like everyone else, but I really get the sense they didn't feel it. I think there is a pressure. You could see it in Johnny Sexton scoring a try. He hadn't scored a try, I didn't realise, since 2015 with Ireland, which is a long time for him because he knows where the try line is. So I think he enjoyed his score, but also that throwing the ball away, that's almost a venting of frustration that finally we put some passages of play together rather than I'm glad I'm back on the score sheet. Like, it was a lovely try that they scored, and So Ireland did create plenty, and probably should have put away a little bit more if they were being uber critical on themselves.
You made the point there that the French back maybe looked at what England had done to Ireland up front and thought, well, let's try and bully them as well.
Mm.
And that didn't happen, obviously. But I'm wondering, if England were to play Ireland again, would they still fancy themselves to bully the Irish up front? Is that an ongoing concern?
Yeah, because that's England's best game, isn't it? Mm. You know, England won the World Cup on the back of that. And England's, a lot of English successes, you go back to the 90s of their back-to-back Grand Slams with Will Carling as captain. You know, can you remember a lot of that back line outside Jerry Guskett? Probably not, but the pack, you know, they were all big units. Johnson, that front row of Rowntree, Garforth and Cockerell, and you know, Dean Richards, all that crew. So they were a big, you know, physical pack, and that's where England, you know, they when they're playing well, they resort back to that because teams can't cope with it.
Yeah.
And
do you think Ireland will cope with it better again next time around?
Well, we'd be less shocked by it.
Sure.
I think we were caught by surprise. Mm. I think we were caught by surprise that we didn't anticipate that intensity, and we talked about it the week after that they. Mentally, I don't think they were right. I think mentally, if you met England in a World Cup semi-final or final, you'd be far more attentive to the fact that this is the likely physicality that's coming at you.
Yeah.
And it just shows the mental pitch you need to be at week on week to be able to deal with, you know, high-octane games like Six Nations are.
Keith Earls scored the bonus point try in 56 minutes and then the bench was emptied and we saw pretty much everybody bar Andrew Conway was on. The Earls try, and people have analysed it, and I think it was Demba Bamba who was the pillar defence, and he got distracted by Bundoyanki coming in, and suddenly Keith Earls is in. Would that move work against a Wales, for instance? Because I saw Liam Toland in the Irish Times saying, what's infuriating about this Bamba defensive error, leaving the pillar and not pushing forward into the space, is that it's pre-1990s fair. It was embarrassing, and Ireland kept knocking on that particular door, i.e. the pillar, drifting. Like, is it just so bad that trying that against Wales would be almost pointless?
So say it's a maul and a scrum half breaks like that. The pillar has to stay put. Mm-hmm. That is his job. The scrum half is not his problem. So Pickamold, I think it is outside Bamba. And ultimately, whoever breaks wide on that, if they jam in very close to the ruck or to the maul, fine, that's Bamba's man. But if he breaks wide in any capacity, you know, two, 3 metres, that is the second defender's role because there's always the option of someone back inside. That is as basic as defensive systems get these days.
Okay.
So obviously, you know, did they target him? Probably. Did they know it was going to be exactly him? No, but was there a vulnerability that they might do that? Mm. Of course. What was more, for me, what was really impressive also is the detail was back in that, where it was all left side drive on that maul. So you see all the players trying to get high, and it's Tadhg Furlong, I think, is the furthest one upfield.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately he is making it difficult for the negative defender on the far side of the ruck to get around. So on the off chance that
he spots,
you know,
it.
He does spot it.
Yeah.
It's too late,
so
because he has to run an
it.
Arc around Furlong as opposed to run directly. And when you're dealing with a winger there, it's going to be too late.
Yeah.
And like Earls didn't even get a hand put on him and was probably a second and a half away from doing so. So it was a brilliantly engineered move, you know, for Earls to look disinterested, to be part of that line out. I've seen plays before with Joe Schmidt where he has those players that are kind of, you know, looking as though nothing's going on, and then all of a sudden you know they accelerate. You saw it with Stockdale
where in Scotland,
he didn't really do a whole lot until he got the ball. Mm. And you know, you'll see it again. We'll see it in the World Cup too, and other plays.
If you were playing against Ireland and Keith Earls was in the lineout, would that be a flashing alarm that something could be going off here?
Or? Yeah, but there's probably other plays as well where, you know, there's personnel in the lineout and they're not used. So that's smart coaching, being able to show a picture where there's no consistency to what the outcome is.
Mm.
And that's what you're meant to do from a defence, from a backline perspective. It's try and show a shape that a team hasn't seen before, that where they go, 1, 2, 3, 4 and line up, you go, oh, this is the likely pay that they're looking at doing. Mm. I think there's definitely the smarts in that Irish team and that Irish backline to do that. And it's brilliant to see in the pack as well that, you know, next time Keith Earls is in there, that they do a peel where they, you know, they hit a short runner or they just drive or they just maul it and don't use them. So,
who were Ireland's best players?
I thought Cian Healy had a brilliant 50 minutes. I thought he was very, very good. Unlucky not to get that score. I think the ref was probably right. I think if he taps the ball on the top of the ball versus, you know, sort of on the side and it doesn't squirt forward, I think that's a certain try. I thought, yeah, he carried very well. Obviously, James Ryan got man of the match again, you know, industrious performance. I thought Gary Ringrose, for a guy that hasn't played for a few weeks, very good in a lot of what he did. He made a couple of errors, you know, he had two quick handling errors in quick succession and then spilled the ball, which he'll be annoyed with after the brilliant take. But other than that, really good decision making, created space for others, gave good go forward. You know, parts of his game that aren't, you know, really synonymous with the brand that he plays, but he's very good at cleaning up a mess and giving direction or giving a focal point for players to then get their shape off. Mm. There's nothing worse than passing on crap, and he rarely does that. You know, he's not afraid of getting his or rolling his sleeves up. And even, you know, that tackle on Dupont, you know, when Earls nudged through, it was a beautiful line-out play, back-line play, where the quality of passing was back really good. And a nice nudge, left-footed nudge from Earls, you know, right down into almost into the in-goal area, and then that chase kick is only as good as its chase, and Ringrose following up there, and just the quality of that contact and the technique around it was outstanding. So lots to be very very impressed with. But the halfbacks were good. Connor Murray was back good again.
Yeah, they've been the focus of much attention over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, Connor was very good. You know, CJ Stander was very good. I thought he carried a lot of ball. You know, Peter O'Mahony, you know, was a nuisance and pilfered a few balls as well, as he always did. Mm. So I don't think there were any poor performers. And I suppose it's funny when you look at ratings and player. I'm always amused by player ratings, and I've got the Irish Times one here in front of me, and there's three nines and nothing lower than a seven. I think the nothing lower than a seven is fair enough. I don't know if it was a performance that was worthy of three nines.
Who are you taking the three nines away from there?
I don't know if Gary Ringrose is a nine for all his terrific work. I think if you spill three balls, it's difficult to get one off top marks. Cian Healy, very, very good for 50 minutes. Yeah, I think that's a fair nine. And James Ryan, I think he's an 8.5.
Well, I'm glad we cleared that up. Not a 9, 8.5.
No, but I mean, the scores are very high.
Yeah.
They're very high.
Almost has just been this collective pain of the last few weeks.
I think that's why.
The context of three dud weeks, that anything good gets an extra point.
I absolutely think that is the case. Whereas, you know, if that had happened on the back of a good performance, I'm really interested to see if Ireland go and win next week, whether the quality of those marks will be maintained.
Yeah.
It'll take another huge performance to beat Wales all the same. So no doubt they will be quite.
Maybe in some respects it's fair enough, because it has been such a tricky period that anything positive does maybe deserve that extra mark, but not in Brian O'Driscoll's book.
But players enjoy them. I remember years ago where we lost to Scotland. And I think the halfbacks it was Ron O'Gara and Simon or Guy Easterby, and I think they got 3 out of 20 between them. So as much as players laugh at that and go, please, players laugh at that as well. Okay. Where, you know, they take it with a pinch of salt, but I quite enjoy looking at them and seeing what.
And you looked at them as a player, I presume, did you?
I was Johnny Waterston today. Johnny obviously, you know, felt a bit downbeat over the last few weeks.
Look, we all did. On Conor Murray, one box kick.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I appreciate you're probably less likely to box kick when you're in the opposition 22 for a huge chunk of the game. However, it still is notable, because Schmidt said in advance of the game, this is not a root and branch reform, we're not going to change things dramatically. We're just going to do it more accurately. But one box kick in a game is a variation. And there probably was, you know, even to the layman eye, there was a big difference in how Ireland were kicking the ball, who was kicking the ball.
Yeah, they got it out to the extremities a lot and then kicked it, drawing the full back up. So, you know, if teams are going to play a number of backs in the backfield, or, you know, sometimes pick-and-rolls back there as well, if you've got three in the backfield, that means you've only got 12 in the front line. You've got to run it. You've got to play. So the only way of then sucking that up is by going wide. And when's the best time to kick it is when those players are pushed up and there's no space in behind, where maybe that you're only dealing with, you know, with one player that's able to work in combination of the back three to get across, and therefore they're potentially isolated as well. So I think they kick very smartly.
To what extent as well is it, you know, you saw the way England planned for the Murray box kick. To what extent is this almost a sense of, like, there's a real, like, intellectual game with all these coaches? They're doing phenomenal analysis of each other. And if Schmidt was almost ahead of the curve a bit last year, and then you suspect England spent three solid months preparing for Ireland and the box kick. And this is almost as a response in a way, like, let's be less readable, let's mix this up.
Yeah, I think it's because you've that much possession, you're going well with your possession as well.
So
why would you kick it away?
We could see 20 box kicks or 10 box kicks the next game potentially.
Maybe, yeah. I don't, Conor Murray's box kicking hasn't been maybe as good as it's been in previous seasons. Mm. So let's go to ball in hand. Let's go to where we're very confident and where we back our skills. Mm. I'm sure Conor will still, of course, back his box kicking, but Johnny didn't feel as though he kicked as much either. It was out Jacob Stockdale, it was Earls, it was Ringrose, it was Larmer. They were all, you know, had at least one nudge each. So you'd have to imagine Johnny's stats were down too, because it felt like they wanted to get back into that groove of playing their way out of making sure that they manipulated defences to do what they wanted to do and then kicked on their own terms. Mm. There's nothing worse than kicking on the opposition's terms. Mm. Where you're under pressure to do it. That is not the time to kick. The time to kick is when you want to, and with a view to actually getting it back, or at times you've got to kick to relieve pressure. But there was very few of those situations on Saturday.
Mm. Yesterday. Okay, we'll take a very short break. I want to talk to you about Jordan Larmer and obviously Wales next week in just one second.
Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
Welcome back. So we're continuing to look back at the Six Nations and ahead to round five. Brian O'Driscoll here in studio. Jordan Larmer at fullback. How did he get on?
Yeah, I think he was pretty solid. I think he'll have tougher days with more, you know, bombs raining in on him or challenged to cover more space. But, you know, when you have that amount of possession, it must be a pretty nice place to be, you know, outside players that are playing well and playing with the freedom. He ran some really good lines. He obviously created the space for Sexton to loop around and score his try. That doesn't happen if he doesn't accelerate at the moment that he does. And I watched it again today, and, you know, there's a bit of stop start, trying to get the timing, but it's his ability to accelerate so in such a short space of time, over 2 meters. Mm. That immediately worries the opposition, and Huge felt as though he had to close down the space. Mm. He came up and umbrellaed him and took himself out of the game ultimately, and there was absolutely no case for any form of crossing or anything, because he ran at the inside shoulder of Huge and he decided to bite in on him rather than being clipped himself. So really nice line, very good kick, you know, to set up that first try.
Yeah.
Lovely footwork at other times. So a lot that was asked of him, very, very good. But they'll be, against Wales with their kicking game, which will be a hell of a lot better. And there's a real focus on Wales not kicking the ball out. If he does play, you know, the talk is that Rob Kearney will train on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And they'll be back for it. I'd feel a bit more comfortable with Rob Kearney in a game like that.
Because there was everything you've said about Larmer there, the good stuff absolutely holds. But there was one memorable moment where there was a high ball in on him and he almost arrived too early, and then he was jumping from a standing start. And ultimately it was a knock on, so there was no fallout or no consequence really. But you think to the Argentina game when there were a few high balls that he found tricky, and then there was that one moment yesterday. And you kind of think Wales will take note of that. If he does play, then we're going to really see what he's made of in the air, you would suspect.
It's not the best part of his game, not yet. And as fullback, it needs to become one of the best parts. There's no doubt we all know what he's capable of doing in attack and running good lines, and he's got nice hands. And he's a very proficient defender. Maybe, from a positional sense, he'll get better, and that comes with time. Rob Kearney was in the same boat in his early 20s. He was still learning shortcuts and understanding or preempting where the ball is likely to be and plugging himself into those holes. Mm. But it's a learned skill, catching and kicking in general. You would imagine that he's doing a huge amount of practice in international weeks away from with the club as well.
Yeah.
And it's a part of his game that just needs to improve, because he's not a tall guy. He's always susceptible to bigger men climbing in on top of him. So he's got to get his timing right down and be able to, as you said, not find himself static underneath the ball, having a vertical jump. He's got to have an ability to accelerate and get that timing right to be able to maximise the height that he gets.
We almost always think of Kearney coming onto the ball. He's never there too early waiting for it to come down. He's arriving onto it. If Rob Kearney was to feel his calf again before a big game in the next 6 to 8 months, and Robbie Henshaw and Jordan Larmour are both fit, what is our pecking order at the moment? It still feels like we're not quite sure where we are there.
Yeah, I really wondered, did Joe hope to get Robbie involved, and give him a second outing at fullback? I feel that's just a hunch that I felt that would be something that he would have wanted to do. I don't think he felt the game lent itself to him getting a proper opportunity in the English performance because of their dominance.
Well, if Larmour had played fullback that day and Henshaw had played fullback yesterday, would have been a similar situation.
Yeah, it would have been. Irrespective of who was there against England, they would have had a tough day of it, including Rob Kearney.
Mm. So what's your pecking order then, or do you feel strongly?
I don't know. He didn't do anything really wrong, other than that, Penaud challenge in the air, and Penaud still knocked it on. So that's something that we're not defending a try.
Yeah.
To say, well, he could have done a little bit better. He still managed to challenge and stop the player from getting a clean catch. So is that not a win from his perspective? I think there's the difference between Robbie Henshaw and Rob Kearney and Jordan Larmour is that comfort. And I think it's the same the country over, irrespective of coaching staff or players or fans or media like us, that we are more comfortable with the bigger men, and particularly with Rob back there and the history of his ability in the air. You feel that with Robbie as well, even though he hasn't had to prove it for a number of years. I think Jordan's not there. Mm. And will he get there? I hope so. But it's definitely the part of his game, if he wants to play in the 15 jersey, that he's going to have to work on most, because as a smaller man, you will get targeted.
You see, if the World Cup was 2 years away, this would be such a less of a focus. But as it is, you're trying to judge, is he going to be ready in time?
That Rob Kearney now has sat out another game because of a tight calf. He gets these niggly injuries. He's 33 at the end of the month. His body is, he's got a lot of miles in his clock, considering he started at 18 years of age straight out of school. So he's playing 15, this is his 15th season, I think. And he, there's a concern about relying on him, but then finding at a quarterfinal or a semifinal that this happens to him. And do you throw Jordan in or Robbie in? I don't know. I don't know is the answer to it.
When are you going to know?
Probably as soon as we're off air. I probably still, for one of those games, I'd probably still pick Robbie Henshaw.
He deserves another chance.
If it got to, I think he's got to play fullback again if he's to be viewed as a fullback in the World Cup. Mm-hmm. So in that scenario where we're playing South Africa in a World Cup quarterfinal and Rob Kearney goes down on the Tuesday or on the Wednesday or Thursday, and Robbie is fit and Jordan's fit, I would like to have seen Robbie play another game in the warm-ups at 15 to fully justify him in there. So it'll be interesting to see whether he does get another opportunity and what way Joe's thinking, or whether he's got Jordan Larmour as his number two.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The other thing as well is Andrew Conway is a very capable fullback. And I was in the studio with a guy called Simon Zeebo who knows a thing or two about it too.
Penny, for his thoughts looking on at Jordan Larmour, that must have been tough for him.
Yeah, we didn't really get into it. But he was he was very positive about Ireland. But I'm sure that that, you know, has to be paining him, that feel as though there's a, you know, he could offer a great opportunity. As you know, Simon's one of his great traits is he's very good in the air, good kicking game. So you know, to watch on from afar mustn't be easy.
No, I wouldn't think so. Our rugby coverage is brought to you with thanks to Vodafone, Team of Us, everyone in. We're live at the moment on Facebook, YouTube, Periscope. Lots of questions coming in. I'll come to several on who should succeed Rory Best as Irish captain in a moment. In fact, no, I'm going to come to it now.
Peter O'Mahony.
Okay. Conversation over, is it?
Yeah, like, Pete's, you're chewing number six. Respected. Rose gets down and dirty every single game. Doesn't really dip below 6 out of 10 performances. Always a 7 through to a 9/10, maybe a 10 against the All Blacks.
Munster captain, captain of the
Munster captain, so a lot of experience. Yeah, very old head on young shoulders, and I'm not talking about now, I mean, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago, he was old before his time and what he liked and what he did and his maturity. So I think he ticks all the relevant boxes.
A lot of people, including Ronan Boyle on Facebook and Colin McCullough, those same qualities you mentioned with O'Mahony, seeing the same qualities in James Ryan, old head, young shoulders. Shane Horgan said he's a future Lions captain yesterday in studio.
Yeah,
maybe. You got it early. You know, you were 22, 23 territory.
23, yeah.
Yeah. Is there merit in skipping almost a generation and saying, if we give it to Ryan now, think what a phenomenal leader we're going to have here for the guts of 10, 12 years?
No, I would be more inclined to, there's plenty of time. What, is he 22 at the moment?
Like that, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's plenty of time for next generation, for as a 26-year-old. I was too young at 23 to get it. It was work it out as you go.
Right.
The extra pressure, I probably retrospectively didn't need it, but it was too great an honour to turn down.
Yeah.
But
that's interesting.
But he doesn't. When it's likely to come, why? What's the hurry to fast track it? You know, let him just get his game, get comfortable with his game, and play 2 or 3 or 4 seasons. Mm. You don't have to give it to Peter O'Mahony for the next cycle of the World Cup. You know, you can change in 2 years' time. I think. James Ryan is undoubtedly a future Ireland captain and potentially a Lions captain, but he's still very, very young. And I suppose I'm not privy to what's happening in, you know, what sort of chat is coming from him, whether he, you know, he's very comfortable as a speaker or whether he's someone that just inspires by performance. He's captain at underage, so you would imagine it will lead to other things, but I think there's no hurry on that.
Okay. See, I would have thought if you say you do give it to an O'Mahony, it's very difficult and tough on him in 2-3 years to take it off him. You know, you would have lost the captaincy and still been in the team. That's horrible. That's a tough one to swallow.
Yeah, but listen, I was still happy to be selected then. You know, it wasn't nice and I wasn't going to give it up because very hard to go, do you know what, my time's up as captain. You know, it's such an honour and it's such... It almost, for me, it was 9 years, so it became part of my everyday routine or my weekly routine that it was. So then all of a sudden when I had that time back, that felt weird. But I was also happy to be a cog in the team and still, you know, maintain my position in the team. And then you have to look on it differently as well, where there's a responsibility on you to take the pressure off the captain then as well, rather than, you know, find it all about yourself that, you know, with a new person, when you've got that experience, you've got to try and help them out and let them avoid, you know, certain pitfalls and not just have them as the one voice that you've got to speak almost as much as you did as a captain without stepping on their toes. You've got to try and find a happy medium. But I certainly didn't want the captaincy to be taken away from me, but you've got to pick those things.
Yeah, sure. So O'Mahony for you, the obvious choice.
Yeah, he is, because of his experience, because of his age profile, and... I don't think it's such a shock to think Ryan could be captain, but I think he will be, but just let him play his way into being a seasoned international, and then the opportunity will come and in the not too distant future.
And
if it doesn't,
yeah,
you've got another great leader that's being coached by Pete, you know, in watching his captaincy. And if Pete remains on as captain, it's because he's doing a great job. And you know, it's just it's the apprenticeship goes a little bit longer. So
yeah. And did it, one last one on that, did getting the captaincy young affect your performances, do you feel? Or was it maybe not ideal for the team?
I guess I probably wasn't the world's greatest orator, that, you know, comfortable in, particularly in stage situations where I used to stress about the captain's meeting the night before the game, where it was just me and the team. And, you know, I was comfortable on the pitch, you know, giving direction or giving out or, you know, praising people. But when you're in a more contrived scenario where, you know, the captain's meeting has always been in the diaries, that it's always plugged in, now your opportunity to go and talk to the team for 15 minutes, sometimes it felt alien to me. And and then you get other people to speak on your behalf, and rather just to take the focus off you. I don't know, as I captained over 70 times, so it's a lot of, you know, team meetings the day before a game.
Yeah.
So, you know, just to try and be fresh and something different. And yeah, staleness is a real problem there.
Copying and pasting your speech from 4 years ago.
Yeah, how many of you guys were actually in that team?
It's hard to avoid some of the same stuff, I'm sure.
And in fairness, I always remember with Michael Cech, in the 5 years that he coached us, I never felt as though there was repetition in his team talks. And I think that's a real trait of over a period of 5 years. Mm. And I'm not saying that that's not the case with Joe. Joe was always, you always enjoyed listening to Joe, and Andy Farrell, even when I was coached by him, you know, what a great motivation. But it's a difficult thing to do, to not, because you're talking about the same stuff. You know, there's not that much detail to the game.
Which brings us on to the final kind of area I wanted to talk to you about, which is next weekend in Wales. And Warren Gatland is a man whose longevity is damn impressive, isn't it?
Mm, yeah.
Gatland's reputation versus his record doesn't always match up for me. Three premierships, one Heineken Cup, three Six Nations, two Grand Slams, winning series in Australia with the Lions, and then a drawn series in New Zealand. That is...
It's a serious CV.
Serious CV, and yet I feel he is and has been dismissed in certain quarters for a while. You know, Warren Ball was dismissed initially, and then there's just a sense that, well, how good a coach is he? He's just a good delegator. I was talking to someone who kind of was around him when he was with the Irish camp way back when, and they said technically he was really not that impressive, and maybe he's improved in that department as it's gone on.
He has.
Yeah. Talk to him about him broadly then? Obviously, you know, the Lions tour in Australia is much talked about, but beyond that kind of horrible game and that horrible 48 hours, but him and what makes him so good?
I don't know. There's such a confidence in what he says that I think that inspires confidence in his players. And I think for years it was not a elaborate game plan that Wales played, but it didn't have to be because they were so well drilled, and they absolutely believed that they were the fittest team, and that if they actually went through the process of what he was saying and what shape that, you know, he encouraged them to play, that they would get scores and they would get a positive outcome. And then when you get results, that inspires more confidence. No different than Joe currently is, because, you know, his game plans have worked for the last 3 or 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. He've won 3 Six Nations. So similarly with Warren, you know, the longer you stay in it, provided you're still producing results and performances and big games and you're winning trophies, you know, I think he's learnt as a coach. He's become more of a student of the game as well. You know, we had a talk about it back in the Lions in 2013, where, you know, he said, no differently than you're a very different player, that when I last coached you, I'm a very different coach. And it was true. And, you know, he's sharp eye for, you know, this small little bit of finesse and not afraid to try new things. And I think that's exciting from a player's perspective of, you know, of doing a 13-man line-out. And, you know, I got excited on trying to, you know, we mightn't have always done plays in games, but practice some absolutely wacky moments where it was, you know, a 2-in-10 shot, but yet he'd be encouraging it to try it at training to see if it worked and see if the pass stuck. So I always liked that in a coach, someone that was willing to take some risks. Mm. I think in New Zealand, maybe after the Lions tour, you know, the respect levels went up a little bit. I definitely felt as though he wasn't respected then there. having, you know, had the success with Wales and with Wasps, and even when he went down and the NPC with the Chiefs, not well, the whatever the Waikato, he won the NPC the 1 year that he was down there.
Yeah.
So he never seemed to be on the radar of New Zealand selectors for the national coach, and I don't understand why. I don't know whether it was a personality issue or what, but he's a, you know, coaches are judged on their success and their consistency of performance, and he's kept that Welsh team, particularly in Six Nations, very, very competitive.
I think it was Tipperick who was saying, and he's been there about 5, 6, 7 years now, that he's barely spoken to Gannett.
Mm. Tipperick doesn't talk to lots of people.
Is that right?
That's not a shock.
Okay.
So, yeah, you'd have to, he's a very, very quiet guy.
Fair enough, okay. But I got the distinct impression Gatland more of an observer. He's sitting there watching things as opposed to constantly in your ear and constantly talking.
He doesn't want to be your best mate. Yeah. No, he doesn't. And I think he'll pick and choose his moments to speak to players. And I'm sure he talks to certain players more than others. You know, I know he had a very good relationship with Sam Warburton, and he was his general on the field of delivering his message. But, you know, you don't have to be mates with your coach. You just have to respect what they're saying and what they're doing. And he would, you know, as much as we'd love to upset the Grand Slam, imagine, you know, the send-off that he'd get bringing the Grand Slam in his final season.
Listen, I was looking back at 05 when Ireland went to Cardiff and they were playing for a Grand Slam. At full-time, Brian Moore is saying the stadium is shaking, you know, on commentary. The whole thing looked like just a wall of noise, and it was fevered and cauldron. So the atmosphere on Saturday is going to be extraordinary. Your memories of that? Did it almost feel like these are not going to be beaten today, or...?
Well, 05 was Mike Ruddock, but I remember the one in 08 where they'd come off that disastrous World Cup too, where they were beaten by Fiji and they didn't qualify for the quarterfinals, and then he came in. That was ultimately his first
one as well. Yeah,
one. So,
and were you played 08 as well? Did you?
I did. Yeah. I missed the Welsh game in that season, but 05 was really important to them because it was the first Grand Slam for a long time. But Millennium's always one of the best stadiums to play in, probably the best. For atmosphere, for consistent atmosphere, even when there wasn't everything on the line, as there were on a couple of occasions against them, but when it wasn't, the atmosphere there and the acoustics of the stadium, and, you know, more often than not a dry ball, and if the roof was closed, so loud. It was one of my favourite weeks playing internationally, and we were lucky to play there with Leinster in the final in 2011 as well.
Yeah. How highly do you rate this Welsh team?
I rate it, but like not as highly as other Welsh teams, only because they haven't been as good as other teams consistently. Like, they were terrible in the first half against France.
Yeah, it was strange.
And then and they were handed the game. But you need that slice of luck. And in fairness, I might be disappointed in Scotland not being able to get, you know, produce something a little bit more on Saturday, but huge credit to that Welsh defence, where it's not going for them in the second half, but they grounded out, and it was heroic, some of the defence.
They made 160 tackles in that second half.
And they were all bloodied, and sometimes they're the ones that, from a Grand Slam win, that you almost take more satisfaction in. I remember, you know, the Scotland win, and no one talks about the Scotland win in our Grand Slam
in 09,
there's a few moments that changed the course of a game, and I remember having an involvement in one in particular, and looking back and thinking, I know the importance of that, and maybe other people don't, but I take huge satisfaction in that. And I'm sure Hadley Parks, who was man of the match and was, you know, battered and bruised, you know, what a shift he put in. So they're ultimately the ones you look back and go, that was actually the making of the Grand Slam, not the last game.
And how do they match up against Ireland? Joe Schmidt's never managed to beat them over there. Now, I think it's only two games, so it's not like it's that long a stretch, but it's a tough place to go. So
not many places that he hasn't been and won.
I'm sure he'll be aware of the record against Gatland.
Yeah. So, I think it's a great matchup. I think there's nothing between the teams.
Right.
And Ireland will really need to be on their game, because it feels as though every time Wales have a championship or a Grand Slam to play for, it's at home. Do they get to play more home games than everybody else? I don't know, like 05 and 2008 they were back there against, and their other championship against England where they turned them around in 2013, it was in Cardiff final weekend, so.
Yeah. See, 05 and 08, that's an odd and even year, so they would have had different cycles.
Yeah,
that
we played them. Now I'm not talking about our game against them, but their final game always seems to end up back in Cardiff, yeah. So, looking at that and the confidence and the attitude that they'll have towards it, they'll absolutely think they're going to get it done.
Yeah.
And they won't, again, similarly to Peter O'Mahony, they won't dip below a 6 out of 10. They just won't. Yeah. You're dealing with an 8 out of 10, and so Ireland are going to have to be an 8.5, a 9 to beat them. But Ireland are absolutely capable of that now that they've had the little bit of injection of confidence from yesterday.
Yeah, your senses will kick on.
I think it'll be a close game. Mm. I think it'll be a close game. Not much between them, but it could be a toss of a coin.
Van der Fleer looks to be out. Who comes into that back row?
Well, it was the one positional change in the back row that they wouldn't have wanted. You know, if Josh is an out and out seven, Pete's not an out and out seven, even though he did quite well when he went in there, and he's a good footballer, so he can play wherever. But you have to bring in an out and out seven, and I don't know what the situation with Levy is. I don't think you're going to start him in the final Six Nations game, having not played any rugby for a couple of months. So I think ultimately, Sean O'Brien comes back in there. Maybe it's unfortunate for Josh. You know, just at key moments in big games, he seems to get these injuries where he's just, seems to have pushed himself forward into the number one jersey. But he won't lose a whole lot with Sean O'Brien, and he's a great man for the occasion and for, for the focus of a week like this. He will, he'll have all the best of chat, and then he'll deliver a performance. So
yeah,
I think it's him, Stander and Peter O'Mahony.
Okay, and then elsewhere. So look, Twickenham 1983 is the last time the Scots went there and won. Nothing suggests they're going to do it this time around. But who knows? And then the Italians against the French.
Big one. I'm over there in Rome for that one.
Are you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it.
If the French are as bad as you're telling me, maybe, just maybe.
Yeah, hopefully. Well, do you know what? If Italy play like they did against us, they'll beat France. Yeah, they will. And I do you know what? I hope Italy play again, and I jest about going over there. It's obviously the game that no one, that has the least bearing on, or no bearing on it. So it's a dead rubber. Whereas the other two, everyone will be watching with interest. But that said, from an Italian perspective and from Conor O'Shea's perspective, this is a huge game. If he can turn them over, it might be the end of Jack Brunel in advance of the World Cup. But also it'll be that shot in the arm that Conor O'Shea really needs, where it feels as though he takes two steps forward and one and a half back.
Mm. He's in the same post-match interview, it feels like, every time, where he has to say the same thing.
He just needs to win. He needs to win a Six Nations win to break that rut and just talk positively that we are turning a corner.
Yeah. Very finally, and short as answer as you like, what are you making of the World Rugby proposals? Have you been in since all that broke up?
No.
Is there a kernel of a good idea in there, or do you hate the whole thought of it?
My concern is what happens Rugby World Cup. I understand why they're doing it. They're doing it to de-risk Rugby World Cup because 90% of the revenues over 4 years comes from Rugby World Cup. So I get that. You have a bad one, and I'm sure there's probably a bit of nervousness in Japan going to a new territory. How big is corporate going to be? What are ticket sales going to be like? So I get that they're trying to look at a different model. I hope they're not getting squeezed too hard by Sanzar. That's the issues are in South Africa and particularly Australia, that the game is falling flat on its face down there. But we don't, as Northern Hemisphere teams, and particularly the Six Nations, we don't want anything to dilute that. It's the jewel in the crown besides, Rugby World Cup. A calendar year.
Yeah.
It's the jewel in the crown. And, we don't want to dilute that in any shape or form. Mm. But there is an understanding to bring forward, the game in other parts of the world. And that's not even, that's before even mentioning Tier 2 nations. I thought, I don't know what the full truth was because it was leaked early. Sure. Where, you know, with the promotion and relegation,
they may have quickly
yeah, implemented. Yeah, I don't know whether they had a brainstorming session where they changed tack. But
yeah,
you know, it's vitally important if we're trying to grow the game and not have it just in 10 countries. We want it to be a global game, and particularly with sevens getting into the Olympics and getting into new markets, that's one way of growing it. But we've got to grow the 15s at the same time and try and make sure that the island teams that are providing all the countries of the world with some of their best players, that, you know, the right level of investment goes back to them, because they are the game.
Yeah. I must say, I do think there's something in it, and more like meaningful games in the summer and in November, part of a bigger competition. Just the logistics, even the travel, say the Southern Hemisphere, instead of going to Australia for three matches as they did last summer, how you might go from Australia to maybe USA on a given year, maybe Japan. How does that work in 3-4 weeks?
I don't know. Not well. Not well.
Yeah.
A lot of sleepless nights for those players. I think as well, one other point that, you know, you bring World Cup sponsors in and they get 7 weeks of, you know, bang for their buck, which is not great.
Yeah.
A lot of focus at that time. But then if you bring in sponsors over the course of an annual, or, you know, it's a global year.
11 weekends.
You're running, yeah. But also you're running it from, you know, February through, even though, you know, there's lots of gap weeks and gap months, you're ultimately still a sponsor of that tournament.
The competition's still alive.
Right through to November. Yeah. So February through to November. So that is a huge carrot for World Rugby and for sponsors and for, you know, for generating funds within the game. But in doing so, they have to be plugged back into the markets that need it, not just, you know, continually feed the wealthier nations.
I'm sure that'll happen.
It always does. Yeah. It always does.
And even 5 weekends on the bounce in November.
That's the big issue with players, and I think that's where, you know, in a World Cup, no player plays 5 test matches in a row.
Yeah.
So I think that's where the frustration of the players has really boiled, is that, and if World Rugby are saying, well, bigger squads, but you can't have a bigger squad and pick a lesser player for a game against Australia or New Zealand that might get you into a semi, you know, or into a semi-final or into a final. You can't have that. So you're going to have coaches still playing their best teams or whoever's fit, and that doesn't match up. So there's still a lot of teasing out to be done. I understand from both sides, but they need to, you know, they need to get heads down and iron something out, because I think it has a way to go yet.
Okay. Predictions for Saturday?
Jack Carty drop goal to win it.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay. And England to win the championship then.
England to win the championship. Well, all they need is a win, and they'll get a bonus point in Twickenham. They'll score 4 tries against Scotland, and even if they don't, they'll score. You know, they'll get 19 points, and they'll have a superior points difference. Yeah. So yeah, they'll beat us on the basis of that. But listen, second in the group would be in the championship would be brilliant, and also the other thing is everyone would win 4. The top 3 would win 4. Mm. So there's nothing. Mm. Between those teams, you might finish, if you get beaten on points difference, you go, fair enough, but we've only lost 1 game, and particularly losing the first game and winning 4 on the bounce would be a huge recovery and a real incentive to you know, believe in that confidence that you've generated over the last 12 or 18 months.
Yeah, sure would. Should be a great game. That's us done.
Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.